in accessing the inner world and developing a sensitivity to our experience way beyond anything I'd known was possible. And it came to the point where I realized that there was an inner universe as vast and mysterious as our outer, and that I had spent my entire life living on the top 6 inches of a wave on top of an ocean I didn't even know existed. And as I looked around at the world, it seemed like 99.99% of the population was living in the same unconscious way. And it was a very bizarre experience because I didn't have a framework to make sense of this. And there weren't many people around to talk to that I knew at that time. But I started gravitating towards, once I'd gotten this possibility, then I started doing a whole slew of workshops and trainings. And I think there was one, you name it, I did it. STA, Eureka, Eureka, the Hell's Angels of the Consciousness Movement. Gestalt, I mean, you name it. I did it literally for a couple of years. I mean, there was 1 year there where only a couple of weekends I wasn't in a workshop doing something or other. And gradually I found myself gravitating towards people like Muktananda and doing some chanting and meditation. And I couldn't figure out why the hell I was there, because I was clear that religion was the opiate of the masses. And yet the funny thing was, I seemed to be getting something out of this. And how could this possibly be if religion was a relic of primitive thinking? And then there was literally one moment as I was walking across the living room to wash up for dinner one night, in mid-step I realized that what I had known of as religion was just the institutional structure and mythic belief system, and that behind that, unfortunately, tragically, pretty well hidden in our Western culture at that time, there were techniques for helping us to recreate in ourselves the states of mind or states of consciousness and insights and qualities and capacities and virtues that the founders had, and great saints and sages had realized. And there were psychologies and philosophies as roadmaps to describe both how to get there and what the world looks like when you are there. I was like, my whole understanding flipped completely. I began to see that religions, at their contemplative core, are actually technologies of transcendence. They are technologies for working with the mind to cultivate the same states of consciousness that the founders broke through into and realized and then transmitted through what came to be the institutionalized traditions. Now, unfortunately, as that transmission occurs, there's a problem, because we can only hear to the level to which we have matured. So throughout history, this wisdom has been transmitted through these traditions, but each of us is only able to hear up to our own levels. Jesus said, let those who have ears hear. Well, most of us don't have good hearing. And so there's a process of what you can think of as truth decay. That the great wisdom decays. It's kind of like a metaphor of a volcano. A volcano erupts and there's this enormous outburst of this white hot lava, and the further away from the source it flows, the more it cools and hardens and becomes concretized and institutionalized. Well, it's the same with the religions. The founders break through into transcendent realms and then convey as best they can their wisdom, their insights, their understanding, and if we're fortunate, techniques and practices to realize those same insights. But a lot of that tends to get lost over history. And each of us is called to take up the practices so we can hear as deeply as possible, because the tragedy is we don't know what we're missing. And the best way of illustrating this is with a story. Think of this animal finding this curious new object. And it has a weird smell and it tastes lousy, and an animal spits it out. And then a woman from a tribal culture finds it. It's a very curious object. It's black and white, and it opens, and it's got wiggly marks on it. And then, being a very bright woman, she makes a wonderful discovery. This stuff is great for starting fires. And then a child from a Western or a literate culture finds it, and it's a book. But the kid can't read, so it's just a book. And then an adult finds it, and it's a book, but it makes ridiculous claims about nature reality, as is obviously nonsensical. And then a physicist finds it and finds it's a brilliant treatise on quantum physics. Now, the interesting thing is, everyone was right. It was a lousy-tasting, non-nutritious object. It was great for starting fires. It was a book. Okay? And at each level of our understanding, we do not necessarily recognize cues that we are missing higher levels. Okay? Philosophers say there are grades of significance, and at any developmental level, when we are not adequate to the grade of significance or the profundity of the text or the person we are dealing with, then we don't necessarily get cues that we're missing more. You know, as the old saying goes, a pickpocket meets a saint and sees pockets. You know? So what happens with religion then is there's this combination of these brilliant insights and profound realizations transmitted, but we can miss them. And the religions solidify into the institutional forms, and often the practices and the transcendent depths get lost, or at least lost to the conventional culture. In fact, throughout history, it's been very dangerous to practice, a lot of cultures, it's been very dangerous to have these breakthroughs into the transcendental realms. Because to people at the mythic level, these realizations seem like blasphemy. You know? The Father and I are one, and Jesus got crucified. Well, he's not the only one. There have been lots of mystics who have been burned on funeral pyres or crucified or executed. Think Socrates, for example. Clearly had some degree of awakening. You know? So to one level, a higher level, can seem either ridiculous or even blasphemous, because we don't necessarily have clues we're missing higher levels, which is why we need teachers. Okay. So,
Roger, you were in the living room when you had this insight. Right. On your way to the kitchen, I think. Right. What happened then?
I ended up here. So that basically that legitimized these practices for me, and I dove into them, beginning first with a retreat with Sharon Salzberg and Joseph Goldstein, and then a few months later, finding myself back at IMS. That was 1976, and then.
When they had just opened.
It was a year after they'd opened.
The year after, okay.
Yeah. And basically I was there because I was curious. My main motivation, I'd say, was curiosity. Everyone has something that pulls them in. We may have quite different motives for beginning, but the Dharma has a way of purifying and refining our motivation so that what got me in as out of largely out of curiosity, led to the recognition that, oh, this is way bigger game than I thought. And I would say that one of the most repetitive insights of all has been, oh, I thought this was a big game, but it's way bigger than I thought. And consciousness being infinitely eternal, that's not surprising. Not surprising. And just to clarify, when I say that consciousness is infinite and eternal, I do not. We need to reframe the conventional understanding of that. Consciousness, infinite, not as in being very big, but being in transpatial, that is transcending space, and not as in being lasting a long time, but being transtemporal, that is outside time. Okay. And one of the insights, that one of the things that happens as one breaks through into the transcendent is you realize, oh, yeah, this is actually, it's a whole different realm. Okay. It's a realm that's actually available to us at any moment, but that doesn't mean we access it. So that was how the whole sordid adventure began.
And how did it change your work?
How did it change my work? You know, it's a little difficult to answer that question because it's hard to find a facet of life or work which isn't affected in some way. As I think all of us here who've, you know, dived deeply into these practices know, they touch us in ways both subtle and profound, and eventually I think leave our whole lives transformed in various ways, sometimes quite subtly, but sometimes profoundly. And I think one of the things we're all learning to do is how to deepen our insight and understanding, and how to live inconspicuously in the world at the same time. That is how the reality is that, you know, some of our belief systems and worldviews are definitely not conventional. They're so-called post-conventional or trans-conventional. And fortunately, California is a great place to have those those worldviews and those beliefs. But if you work in a traditional setting, as I do, in the University of California, then it helps to be careful about what you say and how you say it. And I think part of my work, and part of the work actually which all of us are involved in here, whether we know it or not, is we're in training to be Gnostic intermediaries. Carl Jung was a great psychologist of the 20th century, one of the greatest, and he described a Gnostic intermediary as, he actually used the term to refer to Wilhelm, the guy who translated the I Ching, and he said that Wilhelm was a Gnostic intermediary, that is, he had imbibed the wisdom of the I Ching so deeply he could communicate it out of his direct experience. And it seems like that a Gnostic intermediary, all of us are essentially in training to be Gnostic intermediaries for several reasons. One, once you're into the Dharma, then you naturally want to share it. And that takes various forms. It may take formal teaching, or it may just be in the way you smile at someone, or the most mundane activities of life. But you can't not teach, because everything we say and do is an expression of our belief system and worldview. And so the game becomes, okay, what's the optimal teaching I can do? What's the most valuable thing I can communicate? And what's the most skillful way of doing that? And those are wisdom questions. And it's important to realize there are two kinds of questions. There are knowledge questions, there are wisdom questions. Knowledge questions have a one-time answer. Is it raining outside? Look out the window? Nope, end of question. But wisdom questions are bottomless. How do I love more effectively? How do I communicate the Dharma more skillfully? How do I share what I'm learning as effectively as I can? These are wisdom questions. They're like koans. And a wisdom question is a question where each time you ask it, it has the capacity for taking you deeper into yourself and deeper into reality and revealing greater depths in both. So all of us then are in training to be Gnostic intermediaries, and to do that in our work is, you know, how then do we use our work or our roles as mothers, as parents, as grandparents, as whatever, and as effectively and skillfully as possible transmit wisdom in a very, usually a not very non-obtrusive way. So that's kind of the, it's a game where we're all playing, you know. Remember those posters of World War II, you know, posters, Uncle Sam needs you, become a GI. Well, it's true. Yeah, become a GI, become a Gnostic intermediary. It's a big game.
Yeah. Could you talk a little bit about your personal interest and experience with shamanism and psychedelics?
Whoa, whoa.
Let's see. I'm basically curious. And I love seeing how things fit together and getting a big picture. And so I've actually, you know, my idea of a good time has been spending a weekend, you know, learning Taoist something or other, or Confucian this, or, you know, in addition to the Buddhist practices. So, and looking at how all these things fit together. And gradually over time, I began to see that there are commonalities to all these traditions. You know, we're in an amazing time in human history, as we all know. You know, when, as Joanna talks about, you know, the fate of the planet is in our hands, but it's amazing in other ways too. One being, this is the first time in history we've had all the wisdom and all the techniques and all the practices for cultivating human capacities. And so it's the first time we've been able to look and see what all the different traditions have to offer. And I got very intrigued by a question. What is it that the wisest people on the planet have said are the qualities that are most worth cultivating, and what have they said about how to cultivate them? So I spent 3 years actually researching and writing this book, Essential Spirituality, the Seven Central Practices, trying to answer that question. And it became very clear that actually there's a lot of convergence. And as far as I can see, the wisest people who've ever landed on this planet agree that there are seven qualities that are really worth cultivating. One is an ethical lifestyle. Second is training attention. Third is refining perception and awareness. Fourth is transforming emotions, reducing painful, unskillful, destructive emotions like fear, anger, jealousy, and cultivating beneficent qualities like love and compassion and joy. And then a fifth quality of refining awareness, so that we develop spiritual vision, so we see more deeply into reality, we see more clearly into reality. Sixth, cultivating wisdom. And fourth, the expression of all that in contribution and service to others through the cultivation of generosity and altruism. So it's like, okay, that's interesting if the wisest people on the planet all agree, but those are the qualities, you know. It's like, okay, all right, sign me up. And yeah, and they all have common practices too. And we, you know, we've dived probably most deeply into Buddhism, but you can find overlaps in all the tradition with these common core practices. The one tradition which remained a real puzzle to me that I couldn't figure out was shamanism. And here was this tradition which, according to the cave paintings, probably goes back maybe 30,000 years or so, found across the world. Now, what the hell had people discovered and valued so much that across the world, this tradition kept appearing? And it took me, I couldn't make sense of it, until finally it dawned on me that the shamans were basically the first pioneers of consciousness. They were the first people to develop a tradition of consciousness alteration, but they did it by external means. Rather than sitting in meditation, they used drumming, rhythmic sound stimulation, dancing, ritual, asceticism, fasting, basically altered their physiology and used those kind of power, very intense methods to break through. And humans didn't develop the contemplative practices of purely inner work for until about, probably 3,000 years ago. So then I began to make sense of shamanism. And the shamans, whereas the great religions aim to break through into the formless realms, or the realms of pure awareness, various conceived in different ways, but the formless realms. The shamans stay within form and work with to develop. They cultivate the imaginal, their imagery, the visionary, cultivate their visionary capacity. And one of the things they use for that is psychedelics. And psychedelics historically go back at least 10,000 years. We seem to have archaeological evidence of their use for at least 10,000 years. And clearly, these are extraordinarily powerful tools, and we in the West are actually a cultural historical minority in not using them. And so when they landed in this culture, we were a culture utterly unprepared for them, unlike the shamanic traditions, which use them only in sacred and sacramental settings for healing and spiritual growth. So when they landed here without any context, without any spiritual setting, without any preparation, they unleashed a Pandora's box of both heavens and hells. And some of us here, had very profound insights and valuable experiences from there, and other people ran into trouble. And clearly they have changed the culture, and hopefully if we develop a wiser culture, there'll be a way in which these substances can be used safely with appropriate set and setting and context and spiritual environs and so forth. They have their role. Let me tell you a story. I've got to write this up sometime. Had the privilege of in 86. I'm trying to remember the name of the guy who discovered psychedelics. Albert Hoffman. Thank you. Yes, Albert Hoffman came to the University of California and gave us a talk. And when I was talking with him later, he told me a story which really stuck in my mind, but it was so mind-boggling that I really wondered if I mean. So in 1996, I realized that we were losing one of the great historical opportunities. That it's very interesting. If you think of the early pioneers who did research on psychedelics, Stan Grof and Ram Dass and so forth, those people probably saw more profound experiences than anyone else in human history. A teacher like Anna might see, how many deep breakthroughs and deep traumas emerging and so forth. Lots more than most of us. But these people saw literally hundreds of the most profound and powerful experiences human beings have ever had. So I realized these people were starting to die, and so I wanted to get them together for one last time and interview them and get as much information as I possibly could from them. And so we did, and we were fortunate in getting Albert Hoffman, the discoverer of LSD, to that conference. He was a mere 96 at that stage, but still shop is attacked. So we did, and we got them together, and we had that conference, and we interviewed them, and the results are in that book in the back, Higher Wisdom. But I was so so blown away by the story Albert Hofmann told me that I cornered him and sat him down with a group of people because I wanted witnesses. If this was true, I wanted other people to hear this. And I asked him, tell us the story of how you discovered this stuff. He said, well, in 1937, I was synthesizing a series of ergotamine alkaloids for working on actually handling hemorrhaging at childbirth. I synthesized a series of these, and the way we test these things is we do animal tests first, and only if there's something exceptional or interesting do we move to human studies. And he said, well, you know, an LSD-1 and LSD-2 and LSD-25 came back as animals mildly agitated. You know, it's kind of hard for a rat to tell you it's having a bad trip. You know, it's like, so, you know. So it went on the shelf because it's a very costly process to do human testing with drugs. We never did anything unless there was something really significant. Now, I need to give you a context here. Here's one, if this man had never discovered LSD, he still would have been one of the greatest pharmacologists of the 20th century. He synthesized tens of thousands of compounds, had umpteen breakthroughs, extraordinary, I mean, just one of the most prolific pharmacologists of our time. He said, you know, about a year later, I just started thinking, maybe I'd missed something with that LSD-25, so I synthesized another batch. And a couple of hours later, I just started feeling kind of weird, and it was like, you know, things looked a little weird, and it was like, I figured I must have contaminated myself, but there's no way that could possibly have happened because it's such a microscopic dose. So I synthesized another batch, and I figured I'd take a very small amount, just a tiny bit to be really safe. So I took 250 micrograms. For those of you know, 250 micrograms is a lot of acid. And then things started getting really weird. And it was 1943. I think he resynthesized in 1943. So it was wartime Basel. We didn't have any car, taxi, or anything. So I got on my bicycle and started driving home. And they sent my laboratory assistant behind him. And, you know, as I was riding home, the buildings were looming again. It was like, whoa. And I got home, and I was just freaking out. And they called my doctor. And the doctor came and said, blood pressure's a little elevated, pupils dilated. You're fine. And so they left him alone. And, you know, at the peak of this experience, it turned from this terrifying thing into this ecstatic experience. And the next morning, he went back to his lab, and, you know, he got, first off, he said he walked out in his yard, and everything was clear and bright and beautiful. He went to his lab and wrote a report to his two superiors, and he said, within hours, I got reports from both of them saying, are you sure you got the dose on this right? And so he said, I synthesized another batch, and we took a fractional amount, and we realized we'd discovered the most psychoactive substance known. Now, here's the kicker. Remember, this is a guy who synthesized tens of thousands of substances. He said, in my entire professional life, there was only one substance that failed animal testing that I ever resynthesized. That was LSD-25. It just called to me somehow. I don't know, what do you do with a story like that? But that's what he said. So, you know, clearly this substance was meant to be here, and clearly it has had an extraordinary impact on the culture, and hopefully we'll begin to learn how to use it more wisely. Yeah. So that was a long answer, but yeah. Yeah, please.
Thank you. I came back a little late, so forgive me if you actually cover this, but it was the Carlos Castaneda's material was amazingly important to me at the time that I read it. And there's been all this controversy of, was it real? Was he real? Was Don Juan real? Was this, or is this part of your book, or do you have any knowledge about that?
Well, I know Carlos Castaneda was real because I met him twice. Well, put it this way, he was as real as I am. And he's a puzzle, yeah. I can say that in meeting him, he was a person of extraordinary power and impact. Little guy, but a lot of power. I even did a weekend workshop down to Esalen with his, quotes, witches, which was one of the weirdest weekends I've done. I still haven't a clue what the hell that was about. And as to legitimacy of his stories, there's a great deal of controversy. Some of it clearly isn't true, is fabricated. Some of it seems to have a base in reality. There's an awful lot of wisdom in there. That's clear. Michael Hana, who some of you may know, he's probably the world's foremost expert on shamanism, knew Castaneda well, and he said, I knew Castaneda probably as well as anyone. And I don't know how much of what he was saying was real, but if he made it up, he's a genius. So, yeah.
Thank you.
Ah, good, thank you.
I have a question, I guess maybe ties in the wisdom of the afternoon with the compassion of the morning. I was wondering if you have any advice for how to deal with the overwhelming feelings that come with kind of being aware of all the problems in the world, being aware of all the suffering, seeing suffering. It can seem kind of like you can feel kind of paralyzed and mm-hmm. feel like you can't do anything. It's just too much. So I was just wondering if you have anything to say about that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a common response. And different kinds of possibilities. One, I find it very valuable myself to make that sense of overwhelm an object of meditation, and that in doing so, it usually becomes clear that the sense of overwhelm is intimately linked to some of my own beliefs, inappropriate or unskillful beliefs, and such as that it's up to me, or that various shoulds. So my recurrent sense is that there's wisdom to be gained from those kind of, from really exploring those. Any of those reactions, such as overwhelm or aversion or contraction or wanting to pull away, there's wisdom there. And that to the extent we can look closely and see, and as you probably know, is if there's a complex dynamic like that operating, a sense of overwhelm, if you go into it, you'll discover firstly certain emotions. Maybe fear or anxiety or a sense of hopelessness. Second, you'll come up with various thoughts will emerge. If you hold attention in the core of that, then various thoughts will emerge, such as, it's too much, I can't handle it, I don't want to think about this, whatever those thoughts are. And as those thoughts are brought to awareness, then they lose their compulsive power over us. Because basically, we are driven by what we do not recognize, and what we're identified with, and what awareness, meditations do is they help us bring into the healing light of awareness these dysfunctional, painful complexes. And below that, you will likely to find that when the aversion releases, what is under that, that covers compassion. But the compassion gets covered because of the dysfunctional beliefs and is connected with it. Does this make sense? You know, this is, you know, and then, you know, whatever else, what do you usually use? What do you use?
Well, I guess personally, I tend to feel that kind of responsibility. I should do something, but I don't know what to do. I can't do it by myself.
Yep.
But I think I try to recognize that I can't do anything if I'm in that state of mind.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like first things first. I need to kind of deal with that and I guess not be in such an extreme state of, you know, overwhelm, but to kind of get back to a sort of equilibrium, and that's the only way that I can really think about it in a logical or kind of proactive way.
Good.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. Anyone else?
I wanted to ask you where you would fit in things like peyote and mushrooms and now ayahuasca coming out of the Amazon used by the shamans. And on the one hand, I think it's much older than the discovery of LSD and how they were used. So I wonder if you could talk about that. But I want to ask you a little side thing also that maybe you could tie in with. I was working with young people, young boys out of the Chinatown area that had been sent out in the country. And one of the things I was teaching them was how to be at two places at once, and dealing with being on the beach, hearing the sounds, feeling the air, being totally in present time. And then after that exercise, switching them to being on the street corner in Chinatown where they would always get in trouble, where a friend would come by. And in other words, trying to help them find a tool where they could take that one or two moments to step back so they could hopefully say no, to find a place to switch. And as I was watching them one day, I was really struck with how in our culture, we do not have a rite of passage at all.
Yeah.
And it's almost like Mother Nature stood up and slapped us and gave us the hallucinogenics to make up for that, because we don't have the kiva and we don't have the shamans in our daily lives. So Wendy, could you kind of look at those two together? I hope that's not asking too much.
Yeah. Well, just your point about rituals. Yeah, it's clear we lead de-ritualized lives these days, and one of the things that I think is emerging out of contemporary spiritual movements is an attempt to re-sacralize daily life, partly through rituals, and people are creating their own. Jack has been wonderful in designing a whole slew of rituals for troubled youths, etc., that are, you know, in his usual creative way. So yeah, I would agree. And anything I think which can be done to sacralize life in general, but in particularly life transitions, is can be very valuable.
Yeah. Do you discuss this in your book, Shamanism?
There's a discussion of rituals there, yeah.
And the ayahuasca, are you familiar with that now?
Let's see, I think the only thing that comes up to say is, yes, these are substances that have been used for a long, long time, and they clearly have played a role in those traditions, and they're viewed as sacred medicines and used in that way. and there are not, you know, they're not a, not the, don't produce the problems that they have in our culture, because there is the context. Yeah.
Could I flip something with you? When we look at the practices, whether they're yoga practices or Buddha practices, they're to get to a spiritual place, hopefully. Maybe that's clumsily worded, but I think you know what I mean. We're tending towards that. What if we flipped it and made it so that the practices were practices for just living life, to get along and to develop ourselves and develop the abilities that we've been given? Because that is sort of what happens, or that is what happens, and you have a spiritual experience along with it. So I've been looking at that quite a bit lately, and I just wanted to hear your...
So if I am understanding you, you're saying, well, maybe we, couldn't we do these spiritual practices for life and not set spirituality apart so much? And if yes, and for those of you who are familiar with the 10 ox herding pictures, that exquisite series of pictures which portrays the spiritual path from the beginning, the very beginning of practice, right through to the deepest levels of awakening. And the final picture is titled Entering the Marketplace with Help Bestowing Hands, and it shows this guy with a wine gourd over his back, and the commentary says, even the wisest cannot find him. That is, that at that most profound degree of awakening, no difference between daily life and realization. The two, you know, it's become a non-dual realization. So yes, very much so. And let's see, there was a thought that passed through, but it went the way of all conditioned thoughts, and so that insight got lost. But yes, bottom line, yes. Let's see, we have 5 minutes. We want to go to, do you want a few minutes before, or do you take a few more minutes? Yeah, please.
Earlier you were talking about how we're only ready to receive what we're ready to receive, and use the analogy of the book, and the different levels. Can you talk a little bit about tools and practices and ways to bump up to that, to higher levels of meeting what comes?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, the tools and practices which do that are a well-rounded spiritual practice. Mm-hmm. And basically that's it. And the beauty of an authentic tradition, and I would define authentic tradition as tradition as authentic to the extent to which it can affect transcendent realization, can affect realization. The beauty of a good authentic tradition is that it fosters maturation on multiple ways, including wisdom and insight and the capacity to recognize higher levels of wisdom. But also, they also do a lot of other things at the same time. They cultivate, all the virtues. And those virtues foster and facilitate one another. So basically, you know, the answer is we do our practice. Whatever our particular tradition is, we dive as deeply into that tradition as we can, cultivate the qualities and virtues to whatever extent we can. To the extent we do that, we become more open to the wisdom that's all around us and the insights that's available to us. And there's a good practice or tradition has multiple effects, which you could summarize as show up, clean up, grow up, and wake up. And you know, good traditions, good practices do that. Actually, there was another up that I forgot because I remembered. I thought that was a nice kind of ending, so I wrote that down somewhere. Oh, yeah. Show up, clean up, wise up, grow up, and wake up. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. So we are coming towards the end of our time, and I'd like to suggest that we do what is part of, is just a core part of the, our tradition, most explicitly laid out in the Vajrayana tradition of Buddhism, which embraces any practice session with two things. At the beginning, an aspiration, which is traditionally the bodhisattvic aspiration, the aspiration to that this practice, our time together, may serve to actualize our capacities and awaken us as fully as possible so that we may become optimal instruments of service for the welfare and awakening of all. Okay, so that is the intention we usually set at the beginning of a session. And then at the end, we do what's called the offering of benefits. It's kind of curious. I mean, why the hell would you, have you spent so hard, worked so hard, or if you sat through 2.5 hours of listening to me, why the hell would you want to give away whatever you got? But it's actually based on a very profound understanding of the mind. In fact, all ethics is, the deeper levels of understanding of ethics are based on a very profound understanding of the mind. And the dedication of merit is based on an understanding that within the mind, what you intend for another, you tend to experience yourself. Okay? So when you offer the benefits, when you intend that all the any and all benefits you've gained are shared with everyone, you actually reinforce, strengthen, deepen those qualities in your own mind. Okay? Which is a general principle the way ethics works. That if you think about ethics, if you take a moment whenever you're tempted to act unethically, to hurt or harm someone, what you'll find in the mind is qualities such as greed, fear, anger, jealousy, and hatred. And if you act them out, you strengthen those same qualities. However, that's the bad news. The good news is if you are moved to act ethically, to help and heal and teach, then in those moments, if you look, you'll find qualities such as love and compassion and joy and generosity. And when you act those out, you strengthen them. So properly understood, ethics is mind training. Okay? There's a much deeper understanding than conventional, you know, do-gooder attitude, which is wonderful at its own level, but there's a much deeper dharmic understanding of ethics. And so the offering of benefits is or offering of merit is a subset of that, based on understanding the way the mind works, that when we intend the well, when we offer what we've gained for the welfare and awakening of all, we release craving and attachment, we cultivate generosity and compassion and love, and we strengthen the qualities we're intending for others. If we want you to share, if we've gotten happy this afternoon, you want to give that to people, wonderful. You feel happier. It's a beautiful understanding. It's a recognition that ethics is actually enlightened self-interest. So what I'd like to suggest is we just take a moment. And take a moment to just reflect back over the day. The morning in the exquisite presence of Joanna. The sharing of the Brahma-Vihara practices, the tastes of love and compassion. And take a moment to feel grateful for the opportunity of being in her company, receiving those teachings. And then this afternoon, the gift of being together, to have the priceless privilege of being able to explore together, to help each other understand these qualities of wisdom and ethics and develop our understanding and of some of the deep questions of life. And gratitude to Anna for having made this possible. Gratitude to each other because we couldn't have this time together unless we all came. And just bring to mind or allow to emerge in mind just perhaps two or three things that stand out, two or three benefits, insights, understandings that particularly stand out from today. And then think how wonderful it would be if all people could share in these insights and understandings and experiences, if all people could be graced by the gifts we have received today. And recognize you actually want to share these qualities. And delight in the thought of giving these gifts to everyone on the planet. May all that we have seen and explored and experienced today, may every insight, all our understandings, all the joy of being together, may all the benefits we've received today foster our well-being and awakening, and thereby enable us to bring more effectively, bring awareness and awakening and benefits to all others.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.